right, welcome to the big house.
Welcome back.
We're here, thanks to Audio Adrenaline.
And kicking it old school with some Christian music, just like we did some DC Talk. We're bringing it back.
We had so much fun visiting 1993 last time we did it.
Yeah.
We decided to do it again.
So now we're in 1994, just a little ways later.
and a different band, so
that's
you
right.
know, we
that's
do
right.
show diversity in our musical preferences.
Yeah, two white male Christian bands. Very diverse.
It's okay. What you're missing on the podcast, though, is that you didn't get to see all of the hand motions.
That's right.
That we memorized at Centrifuge.
You're right, or Acquire the Fire in my place, where I saw Audio Adrenaline live.
Wow. And,
yeah.
You win.
I've seen them twice live, actually, and they're amazing.
I tell you what, guys, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you know, so we chose the song, I think, because it talked about a big house with lots and lots of rooms, which actually Chad says in this. And I thought he had a pretty cool interpretation of that at one point. If you look at the top of chapter 6 where he says, in their interpretation, their translation of John 14 is, in my Father's house, there's lots of room versus what
there
we usually hear.
Rooms.
There are many rooms. They think of it in terms of space. We think of it in terms of, oh yeah, I got a mansion there too. And it's big mansion. You know, like Miguel said, he had a big mansion there.
I've got my mansion picked out too.
Yeah, but I thought of it in thinking of it in terms of there's lots of room instead of there are a lot of rooms.
That's right.
Is a pretty interesting distinction, and I think that's kind of what Audio Adrenaline saying is it's a big place where everybody can be, and there's kind of an expansiveness and an inclusivity, even in evangelical Christian music. Can you believe it? CCM,
I mean, and it's so inclusive because they're like it's a big yard where we plural. Can
right.
play football.
Yeah.
That is a very difficult solitary challenge.
It's true. It's true. It's community.
No solitary.
You can't play
Audio Adrenaline
football
music.
By yourself. I've played one-on-one football with my brother, and that's really hard. It's better to have more people.
Well, in Powder Puff football, I experienced the team was very helpful.
Isn't it great that they didn't say, like, where us guys are playing football? Like, no, they think that there's going to be women back there playing football with them. That's
they
awesome.
They know there will be women.
That's amazing. Who knew that Audio Adrenaline was so inclusive?
Well, that's why we chose to start our podcast today with Audio Adrenaline.
Yeah. So let's dive into this chapter 5, which is Ched's chapter entitled House for All Peoples, hence the song that we just sang together. And it's really a discussion of Isaiah 56 out of 3rd Isaiah. And what that is sort of proclaiming, and then moving into Jesus's quoting of that and his connections to Isaiah and the way that Jesus utilizes that text later in his ministry as well. And so the whole scope of the chapter is really about how foreigner inclusion is a major theme through the whole Old Testament and is particularly important in Isaiah, 3rd Isaiah, which is an interesting contrast, as you notice in this chapter, to what other time period pieces of Ezra and Nehemiah. So just for those who are not biblical scholars, Chad is making the argument, which is a good historical argument, that 3rd Isaiah was written when, you know, there's 1st Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, 3rd Isaiah. Chrissy, you're the expert on this because you're doing Isaiah right now. You should be.
That's right. Where my Bible study women at?
They're not listening to this podcast. No, they should be. They should be. Anyway.
So the people move from, you know, in first. So scholars believe that Isaiah was written in three chunks. The first chunk, 1 through, I want to say, 39, was written by Isaiah himself, who was an historical man who was a prophet, who did prophesy for the king and the people of Israel while the people were living in Judah. So they're in their placed land given by God. And then they are conquered by the Babylonians, and they're in exile for 2nd Isaiah, which was not written by Isaiah, the historical man, the prophet, but was written by a prophet in the Isaiah tradition. But it was written from the place of exile.
Yeah.
And then 3rd Isaiah.
Right. Is written for the return. When they
exactly.
come, leave out of exile, and they come back to get ready to rebuild Israel. One thing about Isaiah that's so important is Isaiah was Jesus' favorite book. Chad mentions that. It's also described by a lot of early church scholars as the fifth gospel because it's quoted more than any other Old Testament book in the Gospels over and over again. And so particularly 2nd Isaiah, which is that focus passage where all the great stuff from Handel's Messiah comes and all the messianic promises come that we love to sing every Christmas.
Comfort, oh comfort my people.
That's right. That's right. And one wonderful counselor. That stuff, that's all 2nd Isaiah too. Anyway.
Usually I'm the only one that gets to hear the singing before we hit record.
Fran's going to kill me for singing on this thing. Anyway, So, third Isaiah is written during the return, the same time that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are written about the return, and there's a conflict that Ched mentions between these two books about foreigner inclusion, and a lot of it has to do with the vulnerable state of the people in a time where they're trying to rebuild, and what are each, there are many different groups within Israel that have a different priority. Some want to rebuild the temple, some just want to live in the land again, others want to be loyal to their sub, where they were subjugated before, right? And so, but in third Isaiah, the focus is really about, it's about inclusiveness, that Israel is going to be a place for everybody. It's a big house with, where everybody can be included, right? But that's not the message you're getting in Ezra and Nehemiah. And so there's this conflict that Ched brings up. I'm trying to find this section here. It's mostly on page 95 where you see this contrast where he says Ezra and Nehemiah's reconstructionist positions were legitimated on this basis in Deuteronomy, which specifically excluded from the assembly males who are not sexually functional and illegitimately born and foreigners. And so there was this exclusiveness already built into the Deuteronomic law, or the Deuteronomic tradition, as you might want to call it, because there's multiple laws in the Hebrew Bible. And so Ezra and Nehemiah are really focused on the exclusivity, whereas 3rd Isaiah, which is Jesus' preference, by the way, Jesus never quoted from Ezra or Nehemiah. But 3rd Isaiah, which is Jesus' preference, is really focused on inclusion. So if one of the things that's really important about this, Chrissy, is I think how we read the Bible like front to back and we think, oh, it's all true, and this is just another truth that came down from, that's expanding on the truth that came before it. So if you do it that way, Ezra and Nehemiah are more true than the things that came before it, and then Jesus is more true than the things that came before that. And Revelation, of course, is the ultimate truth if you just read the Bible that way. But in reality, what's happening is that there are books that are interpreting and critiquing other books within the Bible. There's like this contesting ideas, even within the Bible itself.
You know? Right, and I think that's super important because Miguel said it really well when he was here, when he said, when he was talking about his Christology, so the book Politics of Jesus, and he says, this is a work for my people. This is a Christology for Hispanics living in this American empire. And all you other people just get the benefit of listening in. And I think we as readers of the Bible have to go to our sacred texts in the same way, especially when we're reading texts from the Hebrew Bible. And not not only are we hearing from one author who is speaking to a specific audience, being the people in Israel, or the people who are being reinstated to Israel, but we're also hearing multiple voices.
Yes.
So it's this. It's similar to you know, middle class white Americans listening to James Cone, Miguel de la Torre, Gustavo Gutierrez, you know, Estasi Diaz, and all these other scholars who are writing from their own particular place.
Yeah.
So we have to take that same layer of nuance and attention to the Hebrew text when we go to it and read it.
Yeah, so not only are we overhearing a conversation that was not ours, people talking to other people who are not us, but we're reading that many thousands of years later, and we're reading sometimes books that were placed, particularly in the Hebrew tradition, where they would pick documents with completely conflicting theological ideas right next to each other, because they're not worried about theological consistency. They're worried about telling a story in a complex, multifaceted way that gives people access points to understand God at particular times where they are. So you've got how you're thinking about God, like Isaiah, how you think about God when you're in the land and you're waiting for the Babylonians to come get you, how you think about God when you're in exile, and how you think about God when you're returning from exile. And they're all three different social and contextual locations where you are engaging God in different ways and thinking about yourself in many different ways.
Yeah, and also, you can tell me if this is not true because I haven't researched it, but is Ezra and Nehemiah, were they both written from a priestly perspective?
Yeah.
Like for and of and by a priestly class?
That's right.
With the theological motivation and the social motivation for maintaining like purity law and ritual and kind of a more traditional in their traditions.
Yeah, and it's sort of like reestablishing, that's a great point. The priests want to reestablish the temple as the center.
Right.
There's a lot of reasons for that. You could say they want to reestablish Jewish liturgical tradition,
right?
And worship traditions, that is the heart of what Judaism is a worshiping community. And then, you know, the traveling in for the pilgrimages. But you could be more cynical and say, oh, that's how the priests got paid. That's how their community got formed. Remember, they couldn't have land. Levites didn't have land. The only way they had any subsistence and level of existence is the tithe that came from people making offerings and sacrifices in the temple are what paid for the priests to have to be for their livelihood. So in some ways, they're trying to reestablish their existence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to know, was it right? What are the right intentions, the motivations? And you see that playing out in Ezra and Nehemiah in a couple of different ways, some positive, some negative. And so you've got that complexity there where that's not the case in 3rd Isaiah. That's not what you hear. You hear just a broad inclusivity in 3rd Isaiah, not focused on rebuilding the temple so much as returning to the land and returning to the traditions of Sabbath, as he says, faithfulness, right?
Right, and I love, Chad really raised this for me, is when you hold those things and tension, like when you are willing to read 3rd Isaiah and affirm that it may be in places contradictory to what you may read in other pieces of the of our sacred scripture, namely Ezra and Nehemiah, you can see different lenses. So like you can see the need to preserve the priestly class or the temple or the religious tradition, and then you can flip to Isaiah and see the need to preserve the community no matter what.
Right.
So like I had never paid attention to the fact that that Chad raises about the people who had stayed in the land during exile.
Yeah.
So he separates based on class the people who were in exile.
Right.
And it was the socially elite, the ruling classes, the priestly classes.
Right.
They were there, but then there were people who could not, who just didn't leave the land, and they were forced to survive. And, you know, when you're in survival mode, purity law may not be as important.
Right.
And so what happens when your people come back?
Right.
And how do you then reintegrate knowing that the rules of the game have changed?
That's right. Yeah. And it seems oppressive almost that you're coming back and rebuilding a temple at the expense of the landedness of the people who stayed and didn't get taken to exile. It's a very interesting conflict that's happening. But to me, the most important ethical or, I guess, religious argument that Chad is making is that Ezra and Nehemiah are trying to say that what it means to be to return is to rebuild the temple as the central and practice sacrifice, whereas 3rd Isaiah, it's about Sabbath keeping.
Yes.
And Sabbath keeping is much different than just temple practices, which were very complex and involved a lot of sacrifice, uh-huh. whereas Sabbath is much more ethical and economic and ecological, so
right.
it's much more tied to the land, which would be not surprising that the land and the people who were landed prefer Sabbath over all of the sort of, you know, religious practices. It's an interesting thing to be thinking about, that tension in a time when, you know, we have all the spiritual but not religious folks, and we have churches declining in membership, and you have fights about worship and liturgy and what do we maintain and what do we change. This is not a new discussion. It's a discussion that religious people have been having forever. You know, you hear throughout the Bible, God's like, I don't like your worship because you're not doing justice. You know, that's basically the whole prophets. Stop worshiping in this false way. Your worship, I can't hear it. I don't receive it. It's garbage to me because you're not practicing justice. That's the message of a lot of the prophets. And instead of getting that message, we're like, well, you know, what song should we sing this week? You know, and we're missing the point of what God is trying to say here. And I think, to me, Sabbath keeping, gets us to this idea, like I would always say, like, what is the essence of what it means to follow God? Is it observing ritual, right? I wouldn't consider Sabbath a ritual. I would consider it a practice. Mm-hmm. So is it, it's kind of this interplay between practice and ritual or religion and spirituality. I don't know how you want to put it. You can put it a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting kind of tension you see even in here that we're sort of facing now is a time when people are leaving the church and staying at home and calling themselves spiritual but not religious. And mm-hmm. what does that look like? What does that mean, you know?
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that there's a phrase that Chad says on or writes on page 95 that to me is related a little bit to this. He says, he's talking about this whole scenario. He says, we might call this the social strategy of anthropological exclusion, ruling out persons not because of anything they have done, but because of who they are in their bodies and in their ethnicity. And then he goes on to say, we see this kind of logic misused repeatedly throughout the long and lamentable history of racist, patriarchal, and heterosexist ideologies and practices, and it continues to surface among some current anti-immigrant circles, where it is assumed that most brown-skinned people are illegals. Mm. And for me, the language of Sabbath is language that implies release, and it also is related to identity for me.
Yeah.
And it's more than ritual, because ritual is about formation.
Okay.
It's about shaping who I am becoming and forgiving who I have been. It's about, I don't know why, but that's just how I experience. Like,
yeah.
Ritual is
okay.
A thing that I do with my body so that I can train myself to go out and live differently.
Okay.
And to live in the image of God.
Good.
I come to the communion table so that I can remember that every time I have a meal, it is intended to be shared with all.
Okay.
But when I think about Sabbath, I think about almost like release. Like, it's about living more than ritual.
Okay.
It's about transcending who I am and my identity so that all those little things don't matter.
Yeah.
Because I am becoming myself and who God has called me to be.
Yeah, I mean, I could see the connection there, because I could see Sabbath as more directly connected to who we're created to be. So we're created in the image of God. God rested, so should we. That we were created for rest. And like all of creation rests, animals rest, the earth rests. there's night, there's day. I mean, and if we don't rest, we're basically trying to say we're not creatures.
Right.
We're some kind of machine that can survive without ever having rest. And it's not just rest, but then it's like how the practices of rest then inform long-term ethical things like debt and money,
mm-hmm.
and leaving the ground fallow and ecology and all the, and forgiveness, right? Which somehow forgiveness is like written into the fabric of creation itself,
yeah.
according to Sabbath, right? That
yeah.
we forgive people every once in a while because things happen. And so to me, you're like saying, well, like actually, we are Sabbath creatures. Human beings, if we believe, we're built as Sabbath creatures,
mm-hmm.
and that their natural instinct is to be practicing Sabbath. That's what our identity should be, and we are most ourselves
yeah.
when we're practicing Sabbath.
Yeah.
Right? But ritual is different. It's like it's actually kind of trying to like form out the stuff that we added on to Sabbath that we didn't need. Like,
yes.
right? So like we went out into the world and we didn't practice Sabbath, and what happened to us? We got all this stuff stuck on us that we have to get rid of.
Yeah, and I wonder what that means for our legal codes or like political boundaries. Because, you know, we're talking about immigration. We're
right.
talking about documentation here.
Right.
And so in some ways, like, I want to see Sabbath applied to our boundaries.
Oh.
Like, every 7 days, the wall is lifted, and it's, you know, whoever
yeah.
whoever wants to come
all.
Can come.
Yeah,
you know, you can go south or you can go north. It doesn't
or maybe
matter.
Every at least every 49 years.
Or every 49 years.
The 50th yeah. year, there should always be everybody should be able to go one way or the other.
Yeah,
like some people would go down there.
Right,
like
exactly.
they would just walk down there and leave and go home. Right,
exactly.
And we just open the borders and let them go. Or another one would be. This is a little more radical, is that every 50 years we give back the land that we took as Americans during imperialism. So at some point, Texas has to go back to Mexico.
Yeah.
And they get to own
it. Not just Texas.
Well, a lot of
Texas.
California.
Arizona.
Oklahoma.
All of it.
Yeah, and what goes back to the Native Americans.
Right. So basically what happens is every 50 years, you and I become nomads.
That's right. We have
land,
to wander.
We are landless people.
Our land is gone. Or at least we're paying taxes to a tribe.
That's right. Well, you're really getting radical here.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like restitution, or I don't know how you would do that. But it's an interesting thought about land. Part of what Sabbath says is that every 50 years, whoever was the original owner of the land takes the land back.
That's right.
And so, I mean, anyway, it's just sort of an alternative to the landed politics that we have in general. But the whole point of the chapter, to get back to that, is...
Because yeah, we're
on a tangent.
Now.
To get back to it, it's about foreigner inclusion. And so eventually we get to Jesus' appropriation of this in page 99 and going forward. And there's these great little tidbits that Ched gives us about Jesus' early life and what it might have been like that Christy and I were loving about how close Nazareth was to the city of Sepphoris, which was a huge town that Herod the Great built as a capital of Galilee. By the way, remember Galilee was a place where a lot of sort of the bandits and the foreigners and others would be sent to Galilee, and Herod ruled over this kind of kingdom, and he built Sepphoris as a major trading post in Sepphoris. And Chet imagines that Jesus and his father may have been day laborers that went and did construction on this Roman city.
Well, and I need to just interrupt here and say about how proud I was when I read this part, because, you know, normally I don't really think there's much I can identify with Jesus. He was a man. He was a carpenter.
Yeah.
He, you know, was from Nazareth. I'm not from Nazareth.
Yeah.
Anyway, but when I thought about him living in a rural suburb of a metropolitan area.
Oh, that's on Hill.
I thought, wait a minute. I live on the other side of the Catawba River, and I travel into Charlotte every day. Now I understand this Jesus guy.
Exactly. You know exactly who he is. Yeah.
That's the extent
of my
knowledge.
Your neighborhood's a little different than Nazareth. So is mine. But I still get the point. I think it's cool that it's this idea of Jesus not living in an urban setting.
It is cool.
But how the urbanization and the city itself, as Chet talked about in the first chapter, is impacting his life.
How the empire still pulls you in.
But even Jesus was being sucked into the city, which then becomes the pattern of his life later, where he gets sucked into the city over and over and over again to his own demise eventually. But there's this just really interesting thought about how this area, Galilee, is this area of foreigners, and what is Jesus is interacting. Jesus might have been building a temple right next to a foreigner all day long. Thinking about Rome and building the Roman monuments all day long and wondering what that meant. So Jesus is quoting, obviously, we've heard this passage where Jesus quotes from Luke 4 all the time. This is the most important passage, as Miguel said, and as you've heard me say, and as you've heard Chrissy say, and others say, Luke 4 is the mission statement of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, where he quotes Isaiah 61. And Jubilee is his mission, and it's the forgiveness of sins, the recovery of sight to the blind. There is this inclusiveness in the vision of Sabbath. But then Jesus goes a whole step further, and that's what gets him in trouble, is when he starts talking about what does his interpretation of Isaiah 61 mean. You know, as Miguel said when he was here, after Jesus preached on Isaiah 61 and said, this is fulfilled in your hearing, everybody was like, oh, that's cool. And then he sat down and was like, and by the way, here's some stories of Israelite prophets engaging with foreigners, and God was with the foreigners. And then his people were like, what are you trying to say?
That's right.
That God is more with the foreigners than with Israel? And Jesus is like, yeah, I'm trying to say that. And then they're like, you gotta die.
Yeah.
We're going to kill you. We're going to throw you off this cliff. So I think there's an important point for us here in thinking about the inclusiveness of foreigners. And one of the things I said to Chrissy before the podcast is that really struck me about this chapter is Chad is able to show you or show us through how Isaiah's vision is the inclusiveness of both folks who have different sexual orientations and patterns, as well as foreigners. You've got the story of the eunuchs, and we can talk more about eunuchs, and then also the inclusiveness of foreigners. Both of those are proclaimed in 3rd Isaiah. So I was thinking about how all churches think that they're welcoming, and all churches think of themselves as inclusive. And you got churches on the far left and the far right who are both inclusive in different ways, and yet look at the other ones as if they're not inclusive. So on the far right, you've got like Pentecostals, which is the most diverse denomination and yet very conservative politically. You've got multicultural mega churches like Elevation, where Stephen Furtick preaches, as one person said, preaches to more African-Americans each week than some African-American pastors do. And you've got these very inclusive, kind of racially and ethnically inclusive traditions on the far right, but there's no inclusiveness when it comes to sexual orientation. Meanwhile, on the far left, like our church, for instance, you got radical inclusiveness around sexual orientation. I mean, we are wide open for LGBTQ inclusiveness. And there's a lot of other churches like ours in other denominations, and some that are fighting the battle so that they can be, like the Methodists, etc. And yet, when you look at our church, our inclusiveness around ethnic and racial difference is not nearly what it is on the far right. So I guess my question is, and this is for you, Chrissy, since you can answer all difficult questions, is what does that mean? What does it mean that there's like sexual inclusiveness on the left and racial inclusiveness on the right, and we all have like blind spots? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think blind spots is a good way to describe it. And I think it also is just telling about human nature and how groups function. Like, I think that in our every congregation has its own kind of congregational identity and comfort level. So I think for us, we can intellectually rationalize why and how we are called to be accepting to all people, regardless of sexual identity or gender identity. And the inclusion of people with diverse sexual orientations and identities doesn't necessarily impact our worship style in the same way that racial inclusion would or ethnic inclusion would. Because, and that's making a lot of generalizations, but people, sexual orientation is not always something that is related to worship style.
Right.
I mean, it's a, it, that's kind of something that transcends cultural, ethnic, racial lines, right? So it's really easy to include white Protestant gay people.
Yes.
It's a lot harder to learn how to include an undocumented single mom who doesn't speak English and doesn't quite understand a reformed style of worship.
Right.
Right. So one is more comfortable, one disrupts our rhythm of life together.
Yes.
Now on the flip side of that, you know, some of the churches that I attended growing up would have no problem inserting a song sung in Spanish and clapping and singing, or hearing a prayer in a different language and being okay with the fact that we didn't all hear it. But if two women walked into the sanctuary holding hands, they would have a huge, their theological imaginations would explode.
Right.
And so I think there are, you know, every church struggles with being open to all.
That's right.
We all think we've got it. But what we really, you know, that is the eschatological hope that we're working towards. But our lived and fleshed reality is we're all struggling with what that really means.
Yes.
And I think when we were kind of joking earlier, we were, you know, a lot of people say no means no. Well, what we were saying is all means all.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the refrain that we need to remember all day, every day.
I sometimes wonder, like, how we would could change our tagline that, to make it mean what it really is supposed to mean. So, like, what if it was changed by all? Or, like, open to being changed by anyone who shows up.
Now, that sounds like a Myers Park tagline.
That's a little longer.
20 words
too
long.
Yeah, too many words. Well, I tried to get it closer.
I know. But it's hard to make. The problem is it's really hard to say everything with a little bit of
right. But see, I think we think we're open, but sometimes what we mean, and I think this is true of both far left churches and far right and people in the middle, is sure, you could come.
Yeah.
But don't try to change us.
Right. Come and be like us.
Come and be like us.
We are totally open to everyone in the whole world coming and being just like us.
We're welcome to everyone who wants to come and sit in silence for a minute.
Yeah. But I do also want to say, you know, it's really easy to critique an institution from inside it.
Yeah,
right.
It's true.
It's also easy to critique from outside. It's always easy to critique.
Yeah.
But I do think that I think we have a spirit of curiosity and inclusiveness around here, unlike a lot of places.
Right.
Like, I think we say it and we set it out there, knowing that never in this life will we actually achieve it.
Yeah.
But saying it is half of getting there.
And as this chapter says, is that we got to keep pushing the wall out further.
That's right.
The door's got to keep going further. The house has to keep getting bigger. Otherwise, we're not following the work of the Spirit in our own church setting. You know, the wall needs to keep going further and further out.
See, and that is why the hand motions to the Audio Adrenaline song are so critical, because they say it's a big, big house.
Right.
And when you do that, your hands continue to expand.
It's not just a big house.
It's a big house.
Right.
With not lots of rooms, but lots of room.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, I just felt like it was really important to name that.
What a great song.
So as we move through these two chapters, 5 and 6, I have found it sometimes difficult to link the activist story with the exegetical theme, but I felt like these two chapters were just so woven together so beautifully, and in a really easy to understand way. I think chapter 5 is about expanding. It's about bringing the inside out. And I think chapter 6 is about bringing the outside in.
Yes.
In small spaces.
Yes.
Right? So if you can imagine an ever-growing mansion or a church as large as ours continuing to expand, then imagine a prison cell or pod 6 where 120 women are fit into a space meant for, 70 one day?
I know,
or something
70.
Crazy like that?
It's awful.
And so, you know, I'm thinking about the story of Amalia Molina and, you know, just the story of her life in El Salvador, and the problems that were created there, and then moving to America in search of something different, just constantly trying to get ahead of the next catastrophe.
Yep.
And then finding yourself in pod six. And where my heart really broke was when they said that her husband was in, what, pod five or pod seven?
The one right next door. There's a concrete wall between them.
And there's a concrete wall separating them. And to endure this kind of hell for not for committing a violent crime.
Right.
Not for not being able to post bail, but just because somebody in your home country decided to pursue a financial case, which started a whole process of immigration proceedings here.
Yep.
And led you to being held and detained as an illegal immigrant or illegal alien or just undocumented person.
Right.
Who's trying to live and create a new life for their children here. So all of a sudden, because, you know, somebody decided that you didn't belong, you're in pod six. And your children are left to fend for themselves. And there is nothing you can do about it. There, you have no legal right to, you know, to representation. No, you know, the law is not on your side in terms of getting out while you're building your case. And you know, the healthcare, the thing that her husband went through, where they said that despite multiple X-rays and multiple medical visits, it was either undiscovered or undisclosed that he had a cancerous tumor until it was too late for him to receive treatment.
That's awful.
I mean, that's inhumane.
And then he died 2 years after getting out.
That's right. I mean, Americans treat their dogs better than this.
That's right.
Literally. That's right. And so I was just appalled.
And they didn't do anything wrong.
And they didn't do anything wrong. By my standard.
Yeah, they're just like innocent people.
Well, and so theologically, what I love about Amalia's story is that even when she is at this low, she finds her way forward by helping others.
That's right. She finds a vocation.
She finds her vocation. Right.
Which is awesome.
It's amazing. And in a way, you know, if Isaiah is about expanding the internal house of God, I think Amalia totally transcends that and turns it on its head by bringing the expansive house of God to the inside, to the tiniest place where no one is allowed, where no one can come in, and where even even clerics who are advocating for immigration reform are not allowed because of their advocacy.
That's right.
Right. She brings in the kingdom of God in her very presence. And I think that is just commendable. It's more than commendable. I mean, I don't even have a word for how amazing I think that is.
Yeah, it's humbling how powerful her vocation is that she finds in prison. And I mean, I love this quote that she gets from the priest where he says to her, "Amalia, there is great need here."
That's right.
"Remember that your spirit is free."
Right, so she's still in prison.
When he says
or in
that.
The detention center when he says that.
And she realizes, like, oh, like, wait a second. I'm here.
Yeah.
There's nothing I could do about it. Why don't I start living here, right here?
Exactly.
Out the calling that I've been given. Which is so powerful. You know, and I think it's a real challenge to all of us. So I think as we have a lot of lay folks in our church who always say, like, you know, what am I going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they're so talented, and they have so much skill, and they have so much to offer the world. And I just sometimes wish that we had a way to help guide our laity in finding their vocation wherever they are.
Right.
Not feeling like the church has to be the only place that they live out their vocation.
Exactly. And that goes back to that the call, you know, of last week, which is sit with the text and hear where God may be calling you, or what is, you know, where is the Spirit leading you based on what you're reading in this text. I think that is exactly what Amalia does. Now, she doesn't share a story of being changed by something in the Bible.
Right.
But what she does is she listens and she hears vocation and calling coming out of her situation.
Exactly.
And it doesn't, and what she's called to can't even be done by a community. It right. has to be done by an individual.
Right.
And so, like, when we're thinking about how are we as a church and as leaders in a church empowering others in our community to chase after their vocation and to live out their calling in the world, sometimes I think that we get insecure when we don't have 20 people with us, but we forget that calling is often unique and, you know, each of us has different gifts and each of us is called in a different way. So I think there's some beauty in that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think we don't have any excuse to not find our vocation if Amalia could find hers in prison.
Oh, that's so true. Because more than our spirits are free.
Our bodies are free. And we're fine. And we should have no excuse to find our vocation wherever we are, whether we're retired, we're working in a bank, we're working in a church, we're working in a law office. Wherever we are, and wherever we're working, we are the presence of God in that place, in that moment. We are called to live that image of God out wherever we are, and figure out what is our calling in that place. What is our vocation? And then seek resources out to stimulate that vocation. Seek community out that can help sustain our vocation in that place and in that time. I think there's a real witness from Amalia here that calls to us and says, you don't get to neglect your vocation out there when I'm not neglecting it in here.
That's right.
You know?
Well, I think there's also something beautiful for us as readers and as discerners in our own spiritual path is to figuring out, when are we called to bring the inside out and when are we called to bring the outside in? Like, where are the large spaces or the spaces that need to be expanded that we occupy?
Yeah.
What are those spaces and how are we pushing out the walls so that they begin to include more?
Yeah.
And then...
Well, how do we think about the boundaries?
Yeah.
Like, all the boundaries should be permeable or expanding, exactly right, or moving further out.
Yeah.
You know, and where are the boundaries? And let's acknowledge where they are and what they are.
That's
and
right.
Then deal with them, right?
That's right. You can't push out a wall you haven't identified yet.
Exactly.
And then what are the spaces that are the small and confined spaces,
yeah,
that God needs to be invited into?
Right.
And I think that's a, you know, that's a communal work that we do, and an institutional work, but it's also a personal work. Like, there may be some confined spaces within that God needs to break into.
Yes.
That I'm not really willing to let go of.
Yes.
And there are also probably some expansive spaces that I need to push a little more.
Yeah.
And work on my own expansiveness.
Right. Or there could be a sense where we need to welcome God in, and God's presence in and of itself expands that space.
Yeah.
Because God is expansive.
That's right. Isn't that like a surgical procedure where they go in and like blow up something?
What is it called? I don't know.
Is there a doctor in the house? Not us.
We all need that surgery right
now.
We
do.
Be expanded in our senses. But
that's right.
Yeah. I just go back to that, like, in my Father's house, there's lots of room. There's an expansiveness in God's presence. It's not just the house, by the way. I preached on this once. House, we think of it as like God's dwelling place. God lives somewhere. But it's really God and God's self. God is a house. God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and whatever. God, Creator, Christ, Redeemer, however you want to think about it. Source, Word, Breath, whatever metaphors you have is a... House is just a word for economy, and so you have the economic trinity, which is just God and God's self is a community, a house. And so in God's self, there's lots and lots of room. Instead of just thinking about it in terms of like in the mansion that God built, in heaven there's lots of room. In God's self, there's lots and lots of room for lots and lots of people, lots and lots of stuff, lots of expansiveness in God's self. And we go to be in God. When we're with God, we are in that expansive place where there's room for everybody.
Gosh, you're bringing up so many personal theological debates from school.
Right?
Like when you're reading Social Trinity or when you're reading about the perichoretic, you know,
the dance
of God.
Right.
Which always leads me down the path of saying, how can God just be three?
I know, right, yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
that's another podcast.
That's just the way that,
day.
That's just, to me, that's just the witness of
the
text that we have that makes it seem like it's three. Who knows what the dance really is?
Well, I mean, the text is really not about three. The creeds are about three.
The creeds are about three. Yeah, well, you could make it. There's lots of arguments there about
I've heard
that.
People say they want to hear us argue more on the podcast. So
oh,
maybe
okay. Maybe
later.
We need to argue about the
we'll
Trinity
have one
more.
On the Trinity.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about perichoresis that I heard this week that was really stunning for me is that, and this helps us bring back to like our images of God, which are in this text. God is undocumented. God is expansive, right? God is a boundary crossing God. But when we talk about perichoresis and God dancing, if God is a metaphor of social Trinitarianism, what does that say to people who can't dance because they're disabled?
Yeah, that's definitely a limited metaphor.
So it's all like, yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, or I will walk with God in paradise. These walking metaphors or dancing metaphors, they're beautiful, but they are limiting to folks with disability. And so disabled theologians or like Nancy Eisland and some of these others would say, like, careful of the metaphors that you use for God, because when they're used for God, and we are made in God's image, then what does it say to those who can't walk? Are they still made in God's image? It's really hard.
This is why I really love the image of God in Genesis 1, the hovering over the chaos God.
Because everybody can hover?
Everybody can hover over chaos. And I just feel liberated when that is my image of God.
That's a good one. That's a good
because
one.
Not only is it only hovering, but there's also chaos.
That's right. There's always chaos.
And I read the other day that liberals tend to live in messier houses.
I did see that too.
Where was that? I don't remember where that was.
Oh, no, that's Jonathan. No, it's not Jonathan. What's the guy? Yeah, it's Jonathan Haidt who wrote The Righteous Mind. And he was on Being recently, and they were talking about this. Yeah.
And how conservatives live in tidier spaces and liberals live in messy spaces. And I just thought, well, I'm not sure that I really identify either as conservative or liberal.
Right.
But I certainly don't always have a clean office. And so if God hovers over chaos, and if I am made in the image of God, then it is okay for me to hover over chaos.
Right. Well, I do think that there is something about the mind that some folks want things to be tidy and clean. Yeah. So there's like a very Calvinist, like, oh, give me a system that makes sense, where everything is neat and tidy and all things line up and it's consistent. And I know where these people go when they sin, and I know where these people go when they're good. And there are other theological understandings, like Catherine Keller, I heard recently said, that in Greek metaphysics, order is a major priority. And she argued at one point, like, is order a Christian virtue? And
I love Catherine Keller.
Isn't she amazing?
She's so amazing.
And so she's like, actually, I'm not so sure. So, like, maybe this sense of systematic theology, or this idea that we need to have everything set up in a beautiful logical pattern, is not really helpful.
It's not of God.
Not of Christianity. Not of Jesus. Chaos. Yeah. Not of Jesus either.
Yeah.
Who's like saying, by the way, how you read the scripture before, I'm reading it differently. You know, like Miguel said, Jesus disagrees with Scripture.
Yeah.
It gives us permission to disagree with Scripture.
I think that's so beautiful, because if our faith and if our embodied practice of faith is all about relationship and connectivity and movement, like having dynamic relationship with a God who is God's self dynamic,
yeah,
then we have to be okay with mess every now and then.
Right.
Especially if humans are going to be part of the picture.
Yeah.
And I think this is it sounds like a tangent, but I think this is a really beautiful way to get back to the conversation about immigration.
Yeah.
Because I think before we can get into that, before we can start coming up with constructive feedback or policy opportunities or things like that, we need to at least be able to affirm that we've gotten ourselves into a mess because we've tried to make something that is complicated into something that is simple and ordered, and in so doing we have dehumanized entire populations, we have, you know, incited genocide, we've stolen land, we've
right.
built walls, we've used hateful rhetoric, and all of that stuff at the end of the day is simply for the purpose of maintaining the order that was arbitrarily created by us so that we would feel order.
Right.
And
so that's
go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, like, that's where I think that Jonathan Haidt's description of the liberal versus the conservative is not exactly accurate, because I think on both sides you have the tendency now to make things black and white,
right,
and not messy,
right.
And actually, the work that we're doing in the awakening, the whole point of the work is to actually spend a whole year kind of saying, actually, this is much more complex.
That's right.
Than you thought it was. Immigration is not simple,
right.
And the history of America is not simple, and it's not just like you're illegal or illegal, get out of this country, or we should just love everybody, which is the left-leaning
right.
side.
That's the
no,
other side.
That's too simplistic also, and we should love everybody doesn't answer any questions, and they're just illegal, get them out of here, doesn't answer any questions. So what we're trying to do is to show people how complex it is, show people how messy American empire and imperialism is, mm-hmm. and how messy Christian engagement in that really could look like, and then to invite us to live in that in a way where it's not like we just run to simple answers. about things, whatever we want to, we just want to make things go away and build stamina. Like we've been talking about building stamina to live in the mess, be in the chaos and not have answers.
That's right. You gotta be freaking strong to be able to hover over chaos.
That's right. Stamina. We need stamina. I mean, that's to sit in the mess.
Yeah. And that's what we're really inviting people to do. When people are asking, you know, we're almost two Wednesday night sessions and one major speaker into a year long series on immigration.
Right.
And the justice for immigrants.
Right.
And people are already asking, what are we doing? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And the only thing that I know to tell people, I have two options right now. One is get to know Atu Lado.
Yeah.
Which is an accompaniment ministry.
Right.
So it's get to know people who are stuck in the chaos.
Yes.
And be with them there. That is what you can do. So that's thing one. Go hover in the chaos. Thing two, go to court. Get trained by the ACLU and go and be a court observer so that you can hover in that chaos and see what is happening as a witness. And as a witness who is not a victim of the chaos.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think both of your answers are not, I gave a check and I feel good.
Oh, there's no feeling good in either of those.
So this is the thing, what we're really trying to say is, the entire Awakening series is like a hospital room where your loved one is dying of cancer. And you've been invited into the room. I'm using this metaphor. Don't laugh. And you come into the room, and a doctor comes in, and a chaplain comes in. And the doctor's saying, it's not looking good. We'll do what we can. And the chaplain's saying, everything's going to be great. This is what God's will is for your family. Now, who are you listening to in that situation? The doctor's not giving you any easy answers. The chaplain's trying to make it all feel better and make it all good. And you're saying to yourself, no, I have to reject that. So just as you would not want anybody to come into a hospital room, into your life, into your family, and tell you, this is God's design, God just needs another angel, this is God's will, everything happens for a reason, or some other BS line that Christians have come up with to make themselves feel better in the midst of the chaos. We want you to live in the chaos and feel the emotions and feel the pain and know that there are no easy answers to the problem of human suffering. You just have to live it, and you have to live it and hope that God is in the best with you, suffering with you. That's the only answer, right? And it's not even an answer. That's the same thing that we're trying to get everybody's muscles to be able to do with regard to these complex social issues. Is not to go into the hospital room and be like, everything's going to be okay because we gave money to, you know, On the Border, you know, or Borderlands. Yay!
Say On the Border is a restaurant.
No,
then.
Sorry. Well, we need chips and salsa, too.
You get
too,
chips and salsa for that money.
There's nothing wrong with chips and salsa. But anyway, I'm just saying, like, we can't give a check and feel better and go home and make everything okay. We have to build the stamina to sit in the mess and know that we might not be able to solve the problem of immigration, as Miguel said.
Yeah, he's hopeless.
Right. We may have to sit in the hopelessness and be faithful in the hopelessness, regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
And that's tough. That's really hard.
Well, and the good news is that we all have a little experience with this.
In our own lives.
In our own lives. Like, we've all gone through the breakup with the best friend. We've all experienced it ourselves.
That's right.
We've all had, you know, grandmother die at the worst time.
Right.
You know, many of us have experienced divorce. Many of us have experienced immense loss. Many of us know what financial struggle feels like,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And so we have these many training moments where we're able to sit in the chaos with ourselves or with those who we love. And that helps us to build those muscles,
right,
so that we can then go and do this broader work of sitting in the bigger chaos. So last week we challenged you to sit with biblical text. And this week, I think it is the same practice as sitting with really hard biblical texts, but sit with some really hard life gray areas.
Yeah.
And don't run from them.
That's right.
Just sit there. And if you need, like, physical chaos, my office is always a disaster. So come sit there with me and we'll just be in the chaos together.
Yeah, and you don't need to, you don't actually need to have, like, a sad or depressed disposition about it. That's not
right.
The point. The point is to just not resolve it. To not resolve the chaos with a check, or I'm involved in this agency so everything's okay, or my church is doing this so it relieves me of my responsibility. Don't resolve it. Just say, I'm in the mess, and I need to know what it means to be faithful. So I'm going to sit, and as Joan Hope or someone would remind us, discern what the Spirit of God is calling you to do or how to live or how to be in the midst of the chaos.
I think that's a good final word.
All right.
See you next time.